You're almost welcome. I think that there are friends who have recently arrived at the World Center that have come now into the middle of this course. So I might make a few remarks about what the whole sense of it is, what the intention of it is. Many of us, of course, are familiar with various aspects of the teachings with regard to the existence of the soul, the immortality of the soul, and its relationship to this world and the promise of the other world. This has been a subject that has fascinated me over a number of decades, and I collected the quotations which we see in different places and tried to organize them topically, and that's what this outline is really about. It's a subject outline, an attempt to organize material in a progressive, reasonable manner so that one can see the various facets or aspects of any single truth that is being presented in the writings with as much supporting material and explanations as is presently available. Now, you'll remember we started this course, and those of you who are here will say, with the very primary statement of the purpose of existence itself, that the reason that creation has been called into being is that the human soul, which is the mirror of, if you will, the image and likeness of God, a center of consciousness that becomes aware of the greatness of God and of His creation, and through that learns to love and know God. This is the primary purpose of existence, as stated in the writings. In fact, of course, this is the primary purpose of existence stated in all the divine religions, is that man, the soul of man, might draw close to its maker and rejoice in that closeness. Then we discuss the question of man's relationship to God through the manifestations of God, God being absolute, the essence of God, as declared by the prophets of God, the manifestations and messengers of God, is something beyond the comprehension of man. And a bridge has been created, so to speak, a mediator, another level of beings that, albeit in this world, partakes of the human condition, but embodies within himself another principle, a universal principle, an all-encompassing consciousness and knowledge. And from that knowledge, and from the inspiration that these holy ones receive from their Creator, they give the message that is appropriate to each stage in the development of humanity and reveal progressively more of these spiritual realities related to human existence, the nature of, really, the nature of the soul. Then we discussed this question of the dual aspects of the soul, that mind by itself is neutral. It can either connect itself with the outer affairs of the world, with the necessities of bodily existence, of material existence, or it can include also, while doing that, consciousness of spiritual affairs, the world of morality and virtues, the higher aspects of spiritual life. And that the soul has this mirroring capacity, whatever it attends to, if you can also say for the soul, the rational faculty in man, the mind of man, when he turns to these different subjects or different objects of its attention or interest or, if you will, affection at times, then it absorbs and understands and begins to penetrate the meaning of those things. But if man passes his days of existence and never attends to spiritual matters, then those things tend to not have the same importance. We saw how suffering opens the way to clearer understanding, that actually the way that the world has been created, the kind of sufferings and experiences that we all go through, the fact that we see that everyone ends their existence with death, reminds us constantly at different stages in our life, through our relatives, through our friends, through others that we read about, that we're not here permanently, and raises these questions of what is the purpose of existence again, keeps this alive within us. And then there we read about the nature of everlasting life as described by Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá as meaning that state of attraction or comprehension which enables one to understand spiritual things. That just as rational, the rational mind of man is a plus, is that aspect of man's existence which is above the animal kingdom. So the human rational level has this other area or dimension of comprehension and understanding which has been termed the spirit of faith. And we read these definitions where Abdu'l-Bahá says that actually the spirit of faith is the breath of the Holy Spirit, or the spirit of the manifestation, the energy or life of the manifestation breathed into the soul of man. And without the assistance of that condition of faith, one's vision of these spiritual subjects is limited. But through prayer, through adhering to the commandments and laws given by the manifestation of God, one's acuity, one's ability to receive and understand this inspiration that flows in us, that actually is the foundation of our being, one is able to quiet oneself from the distractions and outer things of existence sufficiently to begin to comprehend and absorb and drink, if you will, of this fountain of spiritual life that flows within us as a gift and bounty from God, and partake of what he calls the spirit of faith. And he said that the soul that then becomes aware of spiritual realities, is aware of the meaning of life, actually partakes of this everlasting existence here in this world. It isn't something that necessarily has to wait for the next life. And in that sense, it's as if the soul lives in heaven while it still walks on earth. Now, you'll recall the explanations in the next section about heaven and hell, particularly, that they're not physical places, but rather states of consciousness or states of being. So that the soul that's close to God and is aware of his favors and is penetrating the truths of the divine words of God rejoices in this and receives happiness and vision. And the soul that's not is overcome with feelings of separation and isolation, frustration, sadness, depression, leading to general conditions in mankind as we see today in many places, where the suicide rate becomes very high and the desire to escape through drugs or alcohol increases as a means of trying to drown that acute feeling of unfulfillment, if you will, that people have in their lives, the loneliness that they suffer because of that. The proper human condition is to be in relationship with the manifestation of God and filled with his presence and his bounties, which then allows human beings to relate to each other in the right way, with the right balance, with the right affection, with the right love, with the right comprehension, and the expression of those qualities that we're all seeking to embody in our lives. Now, another important principle that we discussed earlier was the question of the barrier which exists between this world and the world to come. And Baha'u'llah saying very clearly that if we could perceive the world after death, that we wouldn't consider to stay here a moment. That actually people would take their lives, take their own lives under such a state. And it is because of that, because of the wisdom of God, that we don't see this thing clearly. We can't see in the other world. He tells us that the souls in the other world can see back into this world and know the condition of their loved ones and pray for us and follow with interest our development, but that we cannot perceive them except in some limited way, through feelings of love, through feelings of closeness at times, through affirmations that we feel in ourselves that those that have passed on are not separate from us. But still, the whole subject is surrounded with mystery. Then he talks to us about the attitude that we should have. You remember this very important phrase about death being a messenger of joy, and that we should react to the death of our loved ones and of our friends with moderation, neither extreme sorrow nor neither rejoicing, and realize that prolonged sorrow or prolonged suffering or anguish of souls here acts as an impediment to some degree to the souls on the other side. They are preoccupied that we're too worried about their state. And we had a few tablets, a few examples from Abdu'l-Bahá explaining about this, that we should pray to God, we should have detachment, we should pray for the progress, and know that the souls that have passed on are in much better condition than we are, generally, and not to worry about it. There are so many tablets from the Master that give us that assurance and explain that. The soul, we learned, is called to account for actions. This concept, of course, has been in the revelations of the past, that one reaps what one sows, that according to your actions, so shall be your reward. And Shoghi Effendi states a very important truth. He says that each of us has been given a different capacity, and we will be judged in the next world with concern about what we did with the capacity we were given, not how much we did in relation to our neighbor or to our husbands or wives or anyone else around us, because only God knows what the capacity of each of us is, and only He is able to judge how we have effectively discharged our responsibility in that regard. So the example that we should take about how much we should do or how we should live or what kind of sacrifice we should make for the faith comes really in the person of Abdu'l-Bahá rather than any other Baha'i that we may meet. Maybe we're living in a community where the Baha'is don't do very much, and we're the most active person, and we really think we're really very special Baha'i because we're so active. We go to the meeting every Friday. In fact, we organize the meeting every Friday. And yet we may have much more capacity than that. So we all have to look at our situation, and we have to search within ourselves to see what it is really that we're called on to do and to what degree we can measure up to the standard and the teachings that have been set before us. Now this brings us to a discussion about the nature of the invisible realm, something a little bit more, what can we understand about it? And this is a very intense philosophical subject. And all of us, we perhaps can understand a little bit about it, but I don't certainly pretend that I know what all of this means. But I'll share the quotations with you. And this is also of the nature of this class. We read these quotations together. You may have some comments. You may have some questions. It's not meant to be a formal lecture presentation of the subject, but something where we can share and ponder over the meanings of these things together. With regard then to this correspondence between the worlds, this is a very interesting concept that comes up in a number of talks of Abdu'l-Bahá, tablets of Abdu'l-Bahá. It's an ancient philosophical truth. It's been traced back into hermetical writings, where there's the phrase, as above, so below. Whatever is on high, the same thing you find reflected in this world. In other words, whatever is in the higher spiritual world will have its reflection and counterpart in this world. This requires us to examine very carefully the writings about the origin of creation. And in this respect, some of Shoghi Effendi's writings are very useful, as he'll describe, for example, the coming of the revelation of God as an outpouring or a burst of creative energy being released into the world of humanity. And then that energy, which is a configured energy, it's full of potential developments for the human race, that energy gradually becomes the model or is the archetype for the development of a new civilization. And that will become mirrored in creation gradually, by degrees. So likewise, if we think of a, for the sake of consideration, a void in the beginning, where the mind of God or the plan of God is complete in its perfection, and then it acts and evolves creation to reach the point that it was originally conceived to be. In other words, the whole creative process is an evolution towards a known goal rather than an unknown goal. Now, many of the modern scientists and philosophers have felt that this is, you know, there's a certain amount of chance in the way things develop and so on. Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Bahá affirm that all of this is first planned at the spiritual level. and then it imposes itself gradually on matter. It's almost as if you could say that the form of things, the design of things, is the face of spirit in the material world. That form is physical, but the pattern and design of these things, where is this latent in matter itself? If you take the individual atoms and you look at them, the whole design is not there. Somewhere the design and pattern is guarded. And this goes back then, we say, to certain things in DNA and so on, but all of these seem to be rather transmitters of that knowledge than true deposits of that knowledge. Abdu'l-Bahá said in a talk in America that the worlds of God are in perfect harmony and correspondence, one with another. Each world, and here he's speaking about the correspondence of worlds in the outer physical universe at this point, he says, each world in this limitless universe is, as it were, a mirror reflecting the history and nature of all the rest. The physical universe is likewise in perfect correspondence with the spiritual or divine realm. The world of matter is an outer expression or facsimile of the inner kingdom of spirit. The world of mind corresponds with the world of hearts. Very suggestive passage.
Where is that from?
It's from the Promulgation of Universal Peace, page 270, I think, of the newest edition of the book. Yes.
So would you say that if the progress of the faith in this world slows down, does it affect the next world or vice versa? Would it have an effect on it if there's such a parallel between the fourth and fourth world?
Well, on the other hand, we're told that the spiritual world is a world of perfection, so that doesn't alter in its condition. I mean, it's perfectly responsive to the manifestation of God. But here we have that appear by degrees. There's this time sequence of development and changes. But there are hints in the writings that the souls in the other world rejoice when we progress and when the cause moves forward and the intention of God is fulfilled in this life. And also that you have these dramatic passages where it mentions about how the souls in the other world lament when the messenger of God is on earth and to see how people treat them, the suffering that they go through, to give us some heightened feeling of what the immensity of the burden or crime that it is to persecute and finally martyr the very souls that have been sent to straighten out and develop the human race. Let's read a couple more of these from a few different angles and see if we can get an understanding of what the Master is hinting at. He says, O ye beloved of God, know that the world of creation is in perfect conformity to the heavenly kingdom, and that material growth coincides with spiritual, and that the material world is nothing more than published and corresponding signs which denote the conditions and the perfections of divinity in that which concerns names, attributes, and ordinances. This is a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá published at the turn of the century. Again, I suppose we could have a whole course just on these few quotations to develop, and there's a lot latent in this, obviously, to be discussed. We can't go into all the details of it, but this fact that the material world is a mirror image of the other world, that the signs and laws and everything that operates in this world has a spiritual counterpart, which, so to speak, comes first and is impermanent, because here all of this is in flux.
Kind of like the evil thing from this world also has a spiritual counterpart.
No, I think that what we know about that is, as the Master says, that evil is not a positive reality, it's the absence of the development of things as they should be. So where the mirroring of these qualities is not perfect, for example, if in our individual lives we have the potential which exists there to attain to a certain, we've been given a certain capacity and we could develop that potential, if we don't develop that potential, it doesn't affect the potential in itself, but it's rather that our circumstances in this world have kept it from its full expression. So that is a loss, it suffers a loss, but it's a loss with regard to what happens in this outside world. Now maybe in the spiritual world we'll be able to develop those capacities and qualities through the mercy of God, is all we know about it. Abdu'l-Bahá, in one of his tablets, he says that that everything that's in this creation is like a word or a letter. That the outer world of creation is a book that's been created by God to be read. If you know the language of the book, if you begin to decipher the language in which creation, the things of creation are written, then you can understand more and more the mind of the author, the intention of the author. And this is the whole nature of this. We'll come back to another quotation about these two books of God, the book of Revelation and the book of creation, a little bit later on. Again, in another tablet, in 19.8, Abdu'l-Bahá says, "Know thou that this nether world is the mirror of the kingdom, and the former is exactly the counterpart of the latter. The sound opinions of the world, which are the results of philosophical right thinking, correspond to the traces of the kingdom, and there does not exist any difference whatever between them. For the reality of things is hidden in the treasuries of the kingdom, and as soon as it is bodied forth upon this plane of the nether world, the emblems and realities of the contingent beings become apparent." Again, this whole question of how does creation come about? How is it sustained? How does it develop? The discernment, both through science and through spiritual intuition, through reason, through spiritual intuition, of the properties and relationships between created things, between existing things, that one comes to know through experience in this life, through study of arts and sciences and so on, gradually a concept of the way that laws and relationships exist leads man to a sound comprehension of spiritual principles. And those principles are the very principles that he needs to understand to operate effectively in the next world, to have a deeper appreciation of the way God acts and works in the realms to come. So it's not as if this world were a one kind of a world and everything we learned here is useless when we go to the next world, because there we're going to have wings and harps and it won't correspond to anything we need, but rather that this is the perfect matrix in which to form that spiritual and mental outlook of man, of human existence, which will best suit the soul in the next stage of its existence. But nothing is lost here.
Science has progressed in everything, right? What seems to be, 10 or 20 years ago, these theories today, nothing. Now, suppose I believe in this and I go away from this world, whatever I've left is wrong. You know what I mean? You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes, now how
do you...
Can you state it so they can hear it once more? Shifting and changing. Yes. Did you get the question? All right. Who would like to answer that? Somebody have an answer for that? Please. Well, if we're talking about laws,
and laws which we can observe,
the relationship between things,
it's not the things we learn in school. It's what we find out through the study of the writings.
Okay.
It tells us what nature is, how the nature of man is, for example. Totally opposite to what is common.
What
did scientists say? The nature of man is...
At least materialistic science, yes.
So it's not this man is one of those.
Okay. How do we reconcile those two things now? Anyone have any other ideas, Mike?
Well, you have to have a balance between modern science and
religious science, so to speak. I mean, not religious science, but if you're looking at what the writings would say about the body and this and that, and what the writings say about the spirit, but you also have to combine it with the modern science, you know, studying the body and, you know, look at things, because you have to have a balance of the two, a major spiritual principle of the faith, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Religion science go hand in hand together. But science and religion are the same, Abdu'l Baha.
Abdu'l Baha says true science and true religion are one reality. But that doesn't mean that necessarily what we understand as religion now or what we understand as science now is altogether correct. We see that the scientific thoughts and theories are, as you say, evolving and changing, and that a new paradigm will replace an old one as more is discovered and understood. Please. Well, I think that we're supposed to get on with this world, but I don't think we're supposed to ignore the other world. I mean, of course, there's things to do. We shouldn't, you know, we're not going to spend all our time meditating on these particular subjects. It just happens we've come to that now. But some minds are very attracted to this, and they will be working on what they know from the basis of the writings. There are certain clues and indications given which establish basic principles with regard to creation. But when you observe scientific theories, you'll tend to line these two up and see where they stand. And that will make you cautious with regard to swallowing whole scientific theories which probably aren't entirely cooked and completed, you know, that there are stages in the development and understanding of things. Just as having moved from the Newtonian view of existence, which was very mechanical and mechanistic, and that the whole creation was like a machine and was running and so on. Now, in this new stage of scientific understanding and penetration, we see that there's much more at the basis of matter than just hard rocks or hard atoms. So this has created another way of looking at things. Yes, please. Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think, you know, you have to worry and wait for the last.
No, that's true. Please. Yes, that what you're saying echoes very clearly what the Master says about these two books that God has created, the book of creation, and then he has the book of Revelation. And he says that the study of either one reveals an understanding of the other, that there's a play here that takes place, just what you've described, really. One enhances the understanding of the other. The more we know about the world of creation, and rationally and scientifically comprehend these things, the more we will understand this meaning of certain spiritual things that are in the writings, and vice versa. It seems that this is something that will unfold itself through the whole development of civilization, and of course has in the past.
You can even look at, you know, what Mahala says, you know, engaging the arts and sciences. You can then you can take the art sciences and you can take the writings. I mean, we're supposed to study the writings systematically and try and figure out what they're trying to say. But then we're also just supposed to look at them in, like, from the point of view of a lover. So, like, the art of it is almost like the artistic way. It's the emotional way, whereas the scientific, science, is the systematic way of looking at life. That's why I think he says, you know, engage in the arts and sciences, because both of them will reveal two sides of the spiritual side of things, you know, the mechanical side, how everything works, and then the art will give you a little emotional view, and maybe, you know, the colors will make your, you know, your heart ring or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great. That's two aspects of the way of viewing things, too. Not just simply a dry, mechanistic view of creation, but also being aware and sensitive to its beauties and the message that that has in itself. Yeah. Please. Well, the master talks about these various modes of acquiring knowledge, you know, that just through physical observation, through reason, through tradition, and then also he talks about divine inspiration, the inspiration that comes through the holy books. But all of this has to be weighed together, that one helps to balance the other so that one doesn't fall into a fanatic mode of thinking or become so fixed upon the physical appearance of things that one is blinded to anything that can't be counted or touched physically, you know. So there seems that these aspects are there. One has to be aware of them. But surely there have been warnings in the holy books in the past about the most grievous of veils for men being knowledge, that acquired knowledge that begins to isolate or fill with pride the individual, it can become a great source of veiling them to new understanding and to greater understandings. And we find that people have reach a state of having their minds closed, and then they suffer. They want to persecute others that don't believe or don't understand things the way they understand them. And many of the scientists who've brought new stages in the development of sciences have had to suffer a lot of outrages at the hands of those who were very fixed in their old way of understanding things and wouldn't allow for anything new and would denounce them as fools and so on. Then gradually, the newer ideas prevail, and they begin to be tested and they begin to be developed. But it's something to remember, both with regard to spiritual understanding that one could acquire through the writings or knowledge of the outer world, that we should remember that whatever it is, it's just a small part. And I think anybody who thinks very much realizes how little we do know about either of these subjects, to not let pride become a veil in any way. This is something that the master said in 1912 when he was traveling in America, that his was taken down in the diary of Mirza Mahmud, who was taking notes of his trip. He says, "This world has an outer appearance. It has also a hidden aspect. These created things are linked one with another into one system which leads to the unseen and ends at last in spiritual realities. There's a hierarchical chain of, if you will, the sources of energies and the formation of all things."
Can you read that again?
Yes. This world has an outer appearance. It has also a hidden aspect. These created things are linked one with another into one system which leads to the unseen and ends at last in spiritual realities. Now, just about the time we begin to think we're understanding some aspect of this, another quotation of Abdu'l-Bahá will come from another direction and open another way of looking at it. For example, here we have, from a talk of Abdu'l-Bahá in 1904, "Whatever there is in the world of contingency is a symbol of the spiritual world. Whatever there is on earth is a symbol of heavenly things. For example, in the spiritual world there is the light of guidance. In the outer world there is the lamp, its symbol. In the divine world there is love, symbolized in the material world by magnetism. So there are four seasons in the perishable outer world: spring, which brings the vegetables, refreshes the animal, and promises fruits; summer, which charges the trees with fruits; then follows the autumn, after which comes the winter, when the trees are bare and empty. Such is the condition of the spiritual world, which has its four seasons: spring, summer, autumn, and winter." And then he goes on and he relates this example now to religious life. He says, "When Jesus Christ appeared, it was the last days of the winter time, when the people, who are the trees of the divine garden, were deprived of their fruits, that is, of their divine characteristics and divine moralities. As nature needs a springtime to revive the trees, so the spiritual nature needs a springtime to fill the garden with flowers and fruits. It was through the manifestation of Jesus Christ that this spiritual springtime began. Summer followed with its fruits, and later autumn came. Winter followed, and the trees were naked. That is, the people were without their divine qualities. So again it became necessary that a new springtime should come." You see how all of these things in the outer world become symbols for spiritual truths and understandings. In a very important tablet, which I just have translation notes here, but it has been published in Persian. It's in the Maqatib-e Abdu'l-Bahá Jalwa Awwal. For if you want to take the Persians want to take this down, pages 13 to 32. He says, this is in the middle of a tablet, but he's been talking about spiritual realities and how the movement of the divine sons of truth have called into being the various worlds, the galaxies, and all existence. He says, "These are spiritual truths relating to the spiritual world. In like manner, from these spiritual realities infer truths about the material world. For physical things are signs and imprints of spiritual things. Every lower thing is an image and pattern of a higher thing. Nay, earthly and heavenly, material and spiritual, accidental and essential, particular and universal, foundation and structure, appearance and reality, and the essence of all things, both inward and outward, all of these are connected one with another and are interrelated in such a manner that we find that drops are patterned after seas, and that atoms are structured after suns, in proportion to their capacities and potentialities. For particulars in relation to what is below them are universals, and what are great universals in the eyes of the veiled ones are in fact particulars in relation to the realities and beings which are superior to them. Universal and particular are in reality incidental and relative considerations. The mercy of thy Lord verily encompasseth all things. Know then," he goes on to say, "that the all-encompassing framework that governs existence includes within its compass every existent being, whether particular or universal outwardly or inwardly, secretly or openly. Just as particulars are infinite in number, so also universals on the material plane. And the great realities of the universe are without number and beyond computation. The dawning places of unity, the day springs of singleness, and the suns of holiness are also sanctified beyond the bounds of number. And the luminous spiritual worlds are exalted above limits and restrictions. In like manner, the worlds of bodily existence, the mind of no man can reckon, nor the understanding of the learned comprehend. There's a tradition from Muhammad, which Abdu'l-Bahá also quotes. It's very interesting. Muhammad says that God created 10,000 candiles. This is the hook that's in the Arab houses you see here to hang kerosene lamp on, or a lamp of some sort in the old days. So he says that God has created 10,000s of these hooks. And then he's placed heaven and hell, the entire material universe, all of the endless, infinite cosmos, and all the beings which exist therein, he's hung them on one hook. And Muhammad says, only God knows what he has on the other hooks. And Abdu'l-Bahá quotes this, and he says, think of this in terms of the vastness of creation, that there is no limit to the worlds, there is no limit to the material existence, there is no way to calculate the number of beings that exist in the universe. And here he's told us also there's no way to calculate the number of the messengers and manifestations of God in those worlds. That's also infinite. Yes. I think it has infinite meanings that I surely can't explain. But one gets the impression of that the same laws that apply, say, to an individual in some sense also apply to the body of society. For example, there are relationships which you, in relation to all the atoms of your being, bear a certain relationship of giving life to that collectivity of cells that is your outer physical expression. And likewise, the same, Abdu'l-Bahá says, the same, in the same manner, the spirit of the manifestation of God deals with all of the human beings that he addresses as cells of one organism, of which he is the dynamic factor, in the same way that your soul is the dynamic factor of your outer physical being. That one can go up the ladder of particulars to more universals, and each one then is also encompassed by a greater universal at another level. And by learning these laws, one is able to go in different directions and understand the principles operating behind things. That's much as I get out of it. I'm not sure there's more to be gotten. Maybe others have some comments they want to make on it. Look at the seed as a symbol of, it's singular, and yet it holds within itself the propagation and multiplication of a whole species of some particular tree or flower or so on, you know, and multiply into infinity almost in that sense. Now, another law that should be borne in mind, which we've mentioned in regard to all of this, is the progressiveness of creation. Abdu'l-Bahá says in some answered questions, in one of the table talks in some answered questions, in the seed the tree exists, but it is hidden and concealed. When it develops and grows, the complete tree appears. The seed does not at once become a tree. The embryo does not at once become a man. All beings, whether large or small, were created perfect and complete from the first, but their perfections appear in them by degrees. The organization of God is one. The divine system is one. Now, along the line that you were saying, mentioning that man, if he hasn't had the advantages of scientific education, or he's free of the veils of that, and he's just looking at the divine words, or hearing them simply, and we see this the way people respond in primitive societies to basic ideas of the faith, how they're able to respond to them at a heart level and be animated and energized by them. Abdu'l-Bahá gives some clues about this in another selection here from a table talk. He says, all teaching and knowledge are enclosed in the soul of man. All teaching and knowledge are enclosed in the soul of man, because his soul encompasses everything. It is not physical nor restricted to a single place. It is a spiritual reality. Therefore, it is not limited by time and space in its inner reality. To study means to bring them, these teachings and knowledge, to light. For instance, the flower, fruits, and leaves are contained in the seed, and with the heat, light, and soil, the fruits are manifested. The figure is contained in the mirror, but the mirror of itself has not the power to reflect it. Polishing is necessary in order to give out a perfect reflection. Even on this wall, must have indicated some wall is there exists the possibility of a reflection, but it needs polishing to bring out the reflection. So, he says, study is polishing. And now the quotation we were mentioning earlier about the two books. This is also from a tablet of Abdu'l-Bahá. There are two books. One is the book of creation, and the other is the written book. The written book consisteth of the heavenly books, which are revealed to the prophets of God and have issued forth from the lips of his manifestations. The book of creation is the preserved tablet in the outspread roll of existence. Now you'll find these terms translated in different ways in the writings. You start looking for them, the outward roll of existence, meaning this material, outer phenomenal world. Then he goes on to state, the book of creation is in accord with the written book. In the written book thou canst find chapters and verses, words and letters, and inner meanings and mysteries are hidden therein. Likewise, the book of creation is the command of God and the repository of divine mysteries. In it there are great signs, universal images, perfect words, exalted symbols, and secrets of all things, whether of the past or of the future. When thou readest the written book, thou wilt become aware of the mysteries of God. But when thou gazest at the book of creation, thou wilt observe the signs, symbols, realities, and reflections of the hidden mysteries of the bounties of His Holiness, the Incomparable One. In the world of the Holy Writ, or Holy Word, there are letters, words, and verses, and likewise in the world of creation there are letters, words, and verses. Creation is in accord with the written word, and this is certain. Yes? Yes, if I'm understanding what you're saying, in the first case, if you just study the outer world of creation, unaided by the written book, you won't penetrate the meanings in a complete way. As the writings state very clearly, we need the manifestation of God to reveal certain clues and secrets to us and to energize us in a way that we can comprehend and correlate things. Well, they may not be able to relate it back to God, but sometimes they relate it back to a source of a higher pattern, or, you know, there's various statements by scientists who don't necessarily say they believe in God or that they believe in some particular messenger of God, but they're in awe before the hidden capacity of the creation, you know. So in a sense they worship through the book of creation to a certain degree. They stand in awe of that. And some of them then connect this also with the... I think if many of them could see the writings of Baha'u'llah and Abdu'l-Baha on these subjects, they would be confirmed in other ways, in other understandings. But it seems to need both, that one complements the understanding of the other. So perhaps people who have a deep grasp of material sciences and understanding of things would have a greater appreciation of passages that say, I've not studied some particular science or things, I would miss that Abdu'l-Baha is what he's referring to. This is why Baha'u'llah calls upon us to acquire knowledge of all the arts and sciences. But now we're doing that as a commandment from God through his book, rather than acquiring them independent of that. And that's where the danger of the pride comes in, you know, the veil of knowledge. We don't want to not acquire everything that we can to study and be alert to the book of creation, know everything we can about it. So it will help us to draw clear conclusions, because it is a full symbol of spiritual things. We'll be able to understand spiritual things better. In another talk in America, the master said, when we carefully investigate the kingdoms of existence and observe the phenomena of the universe about us, we discover the absolute order and perfection of creation. The dull minerals in their affinities, plants and vegetables with the power of growth, animals in their instinct, man with conscious intellect, and the heavenly orbs moving obediently through limitless space, are all found subject to universal law, most complete, most perfect. That is why a wise philosopher has said, there is no greater or more perfect system of creation than that which already exists. And in Islam he says, you know, behold the world. Can you imagine a more perfect one? Can you think how to change it in some way that would make it more perfect? What goes wrong is man not living up to his potential. That's where the component of evil appears. Now there's two passages here that they're somewhat similar, and they are also very interesting from the point of view of growth and development. From what Abdu'l-Baha tells us, the spiritual capacity requires, or spiritual development requires, capacity. First, capacity has to be created in matter. That the forces of existence move things towards certain stages of development and evolution, and then new patterns appear. For example, Abdu'l-Baha talks about the configuration of material substances that give birth to animal life, or to vegetable life at that stage of development. That all of the laws that operate at the vegetable level of existence require a certain condition in the mineral kingdom to make their appearance. When that condition is there, that higher power and design will become manifest. So it's a building or working out of a preconceived spiritual or material design that's coming out into creation by stages. Likewise, he talks about the child, the embryo, in the womb of its mother. The soul is connected to it. It has its capacity and gifts, but it can't manifest those capacities and gifts from the beginning, only some of it, but in an incomplete form. But as the child grows and develops, gradually it ripens like a fruit ripens, in a sense. And the intellect, the powers of intellect and independent thought become seated in it and develop and sharpen and grow as the individual grows. Likewise, the Master says, spiritual gifts and the bounties that come to us from God through spiritual rebirth, that is, through the quality of faith, which opens us to the inspiration which comes from the Word of God, whether the Word of God in the book or the Word of God in the sense that that's the breath of life that's breathing in us. As we gain capacity for those, then those gifts appear within us. And in a very subtle way, action of faith, that is, not knowing, but acting on faith, doing what the manifestation says, creates capacity in us. He says, arise and serve. He says, don't lie. He says, do this, do that. As we try it, we find that we are assisted and that our understanding and comprehension of the reason why he has told us to do something is confirmed and is developed and ripens in us. He says, and this is first from a tablet, verily I say unto thee that the gifts of thy Lord are encircling thee in a similar way as the spirit encircles the body at the beginning of the amalgamation of the elements and natures in the womb. The power of the spirit begins then to appear in the body gradually and successively according to the preparation and capacity to receive that everlasting abundance. That's cited in the volume Baha'i World Faith, page 367, if you want to look it up. Then, in one of the talks in America, found in Promulgation, page 159, he says, in the same manner, the bestowals of God are moving and circulating throughout all created things. This illimitable divine bounty has no beginning and will have no ending. It is moving, circulating, and becomes effective wherever capacity is developed to receive it. In every station, there is a specialized capacity. Just as the potentialities of your being have been set from the outset, from the beginning of your creation, and as you grow and develop, your potentialities will appear in you, the gifts and bounties that are in your nature will be developed. In the same way, the Master tells us that the capacity for a new civilization, for a new stage of human development, that the manifestation of God breathes into creation when he appears in the world, impregnating it with the potentialities and possibilities of this development, will gradually appear in society as the individuals acquire capacity collectively to express this. Now you see the influence that's coming into the world now because Baha'u'llah has said this is the call of the hour of the unity of mankind. It's taking a century and a half, but gradually this is coming into the common consciousness of people, that we're, after all, really one people that are living on the planet. We should mend our differences. We should find a way. And this is a groundswell that's coming up from the people. Maybe this is what the Master says, that this universal peace will be established because the governments of the world will be forced into it. It has something to do with what the people will be telling them. We see these latest developments in Eastern Europe and so on, how much what the people think when it gets expressed drives the direction of things. Now, they're also, in a sense, animated by the spirit of the time. If their thoughts and their ideals correspond with the purpose and intention of God, they become active, they're moved, they're impelled forward. And gradually these patterns and the purpose of God for the time we live in will be worked out in society. We see it coming. Someone wanted something like that. Now, here's another very suggestive passage. I think, you know, for me, I have these in a notebook and I read them over and over again and ponder on them. I don't intend to say that I understand what they mean, but I think it's very good for us to know that they're there, and there'll be times when we'll think about them and maybe we'll catch some aspect of their meaning. This is in the book Divine Philosophy, from a talk of Abdu'l-Bahá. He says, all the visible material events are interrelated with invisible spiritual forces. The infinite phenomena of creation are interdependent as the links of a chain. When certain links become rusty, they are broken by unseen forces to be replaced by newer and better ones. There are certain colossal events which transpire in the world of humanity which are required by the nature of the times. Now, I don't mean to reduce this to something just of the moment, but I think that things of the moment are very similar to what's being stated here. And if just the developments in society in the last 4 or 5 months, last year, I think is an outer demonstration of what we've just read. I'll read it again. Do you want to hear it again?
Yes, read it again.
Okay. All the visible material events are interrelated with invisible spiritual forces. The infinite phenomena of creation are interdependent as the links of a chain. When certain links become rusty, they are broken by unseen forces to be replaced by newer and better ones. There are certain colossal events which transpire in the world of humanity which are required by the nature of the times. Now, some of you have heard reference to the concept of Dr. Prigozhin about dissipative structures, which I don't fully understand, but I can give you a summary of how much I do understand of it, and you can read more about it in the papers that describe it. Let's say we have a force field that is in balance, or whatever the proper word is, in equilibrium to some degree, or at least the various forces in it are balanced. If you introduce a new element into this force field, you upset the equilibrium of it. It will either have to accommodate this new force in some way and absorb it within its old pattern and settles down again and holds that in check. Or if the outer force that's acting on this field is strong enough, it will cause it to completely come apart. Then it will refigure, it will reconfigure itself in a new pattern with the new presence of this new force fully playing its part. And in a sense, he describes this in chemical patterns, where there's a transcendence to a more efficient use of the various elements or pressures or challenges that exist in any particular circumstance, biological or otherwise. In one of the explanations, we say, for instance, you've got traffic patterns in Haifa, for example, and gradually you introduce enough cars that the congestion is total and there's a crisis, there's a complete breakdown. You've introduced new energies, that suddenly it's too much. The old system will not work, it has to be redesigned. So suddenly you have a crisis, you have to remake roads, you have to do all kinds of things in order to accommodate this new challenge or new level of traffic. Now, Baha'u'llah says that the world's equilibrium has been, what does he say? Has been upset through the vibrating influence of this most great revelation. So you have the manifestation of God come, he breathes a new call into existence, and then the old forms of existence are not sufficient for this. And so these rusty links, so to speak, are destroyed. And things come apart for a while, only to be reconstructed or a new order rolled out in their stead, so to speak, and one that is in conformity with this law of oneness and the unity of mankind and all the things that we're working for, the ideals that we're working for. And we know this operates at two levels. One, in one, our part is to publish the literature and promulgate the knowledge of the teachings to the best we can. But on the other hand, all of these energies and forces have been released, and they are operating, and they are driving processes that are unseen and, for the most part, unperceived by us, that are leading to the same end. And these two, the work of the Baha'is to bring these ideals to the attention of humanity, the forces which are undoing and rebinding things in different ways, come together and create the beginning of this new civilization, which we hope is not too far away and not on the other side of too much suffering. Mark, please. Yeah, we see how the lives of certain individuals have such an impact on everybody else's lives in the world. It's amazing. Well, I think we've been, you know, musing on this subject here most of the evening. There are more, obviously more quotations, some of which you may be able to dig out yourselves if you take interest in this particular dimension of the writing, and collect for yourselves. Maybe sometime in the future we can work out a course on creation and the different aspects of creation. But beyond that, we'll be talking next week about some of these symbols found in the writings, like Supreme Concourse and Maids of Heaven. We'll go in a little more detail on those subjects. And then we'll get back on the track where we were the week before last with regard to the conditions of the soul in the worlds to come. Friends, I understand we have some guests here tonight. The